This is Hacker Daily for Friday, May 25th. Today we're talking about CEO advice from the founder of Mixpanel, mental models, and the perception of privacy issues in the tech community. I'm Harish Agarwal, flying solo this week. Dave is speaking at a conference in Poland. And thanks for tuning in to Hacker Daily, featuring top stories for hackers, founders, and makers. Remember to subscribe and rate us on your podcast app. Suhail Doshi, founder of Mixpanel, posted a well-received tweet storm about his experiences as CEO of Mixpanel. Mixpanel is an analytics company which I've been following for some time. Anyone who has started a web company in the last decade has probably had the experience of using Google Analytics, becoming extremely frustrated with that experience, and looking for something better. Mixpanel was the first analytics product I used which definitively offered something better. Doshi recently stepped down as CEO of Mixpanel after a nearly decade-long run and is now taking on the role of chairman of the board. Since leaving, he's been reflecting on his time at Mixpanel. This is a reading of his latest reflection. I became CEO at 20. I dropped out of college. I had only interned somewhere previously. Looking back, I couldn't imagine the journey that would occur from writing code all day to scaling to 300 people. I got lucky. I screwed up a lot and had a lot of help. Here's what I learned. Giving up control is hard, and it was the hardest for me. I felt like everything at the beginning was important. You can't be good at everything, though. As you grow, I learned it's important to consciously give up things constantly. If you don't, you won't scale and everything suffers. Your VCs won't want to offend you, so I'll suggest it. Get a CEO coach and do a 360 review of yourself every few years. It was life-changing for me. You can't fix everything about yourself. Focus on 2 to 3 things each year. Tell your company you're doing it. It'll build trust. Over time, you will feel like all you're doing is spending time in meetings, but not getting any real work done. You are, though. Your job is now helping other people through the medium of meeting. Don't resist it. Embrace it. Now's the time to design it to be fun and productive. Find a great mentor. Pick someone you want to impress. Find someone who will lift you up when you're down and take you down a notch when you're overconfident. Ideally, they've been a CEO or founder before, so they can empathize. Remember, though, they offer guidance, not a script. Live by the mantra, you should be building a team that can fulfill the mission without you. You will be less stressed in the long run. Keep empowering others. When you forget, try and ask yourself why you started this thing in the first place. Was it really about money or power or ego? Power is responsibility. Being CEO will become lonely as you can't be as vulnerable and authentic as you'd like. Find other founders who will be real with you. Have dinners with them and share problems openly. I've been given hugs by them during tough times. It made the difference. Don't avoid confrontation with tough, critical decisions. Deal with it head on. Avoiding confrontation builds resentment over time. It slows the company down, and relationships eventually turn sour in an irrevocable way, creating instability. Attack problems, not people. You will royally screw it up with people in your company even if it wasn't your decision. They may dislike you for a long time. The words, "I am sorry, I screwed up," are some of the most powerful words you can ever say to someone. It won't always fix it, though. Your job will become 90% listening, 10% talking. I was bad at this and had to work 2 times as hard at not interrupting people. Best solution I found after 9.5 years was to write things down during a meeting. It made me focus on what they were saying and showed I was listening. Your intuition about customers or the market will get worse as the organization grows, and you become further estranged from customers. Keep empowering others, but hold them accountable. Spend time learning from them. Stick to the facts, not their opinions, when making decisions. Discovering the truth becomes hard as you grow. It also becomes the most important thing you can do as you guide the company. Make acquiring it and using it for a decision as part of the culture somehow. I did this by constantly asking people what the actual facts were. Control your mood meeting to meeting. Sometimes you will have a bad, devastating meeting, But try to remember that the next set of people don't have that context, and they may be excited or stressed to meet with you. We're all human and have our insecurities, so consider a therapist to assist in helping with your personal psychology. If you associate a stigma with it, know that I did too. I was wrong and wished I had done this earlier in life. It will be invaluable if you tend to bring it home. Finally, keep working hard to improve. You can't fix mistakes of the past, but you can be better in the future. Don't give up. When you make hard decisions, you get to know which values or principles you truly stand for. That alone makes the journey worth it. In another lifetime, I was a physics grad student. My first teaching assignment was for an introductory physics class for pre-meds. In my mind at the time, there could not be a greater clash of pedagogies than pre-med and physics. Biology and medicine seemed to be a land of rote memorization and standing out by virtue of performance on tests. Physics was the land of mental models, where understanding the world via a conceptual framework was so core to doing well, and most students stood out by virtue of applying those frameworks in a research setting. I know now how wrong I was. Every corner of human knowledge rests on top of mental models, and experts in the field know and apply these models reflexively. Biologists have mental models to describe complex systems. The difference with physics being that these systems are still at the frontiers of human knowledge, and so the mental models are constantly updated and changing. Tech entrepreneurs are also constantly employing mental models, whether it's implicitly or explicitly known, to understand their business and how the world affects it. We instinctively embrace writing which rests on these mental models. The most recent example I can think of is Patrick McKenzie's excellent series of blogs on software as a service businesses for Stripe. The blogs stand out as foundational knowledge for SaaS businesses, a framework for evaluating how to start and run a SaaS business. They capture mental models for SaaS startups. Charlie Munger, the vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company, has long been an advocate of learning as many mental models from as many disciplines as possible. He says of them, "You've got to have models in your head, and you've got to array your experience, both vicarious and direct, on this latticework of models." You may have noticed students who just try to remember and pound back what is remembered. Well, they fail in school and in life. You've got to hang experience on a latticework of models in your head. Shane Parrish, creator of Farnham Street, has an excellent resource documenting many of these mental models which anyone can read about and familiarize themselves with. Parrish says of employing these models, "You'll know you're onto something when ideas start to compete with one another. You'll find situations where Model 1 tells you X and Model 2 tells you Y. Believe it or not, this is a sign that you're on the right track. Letting the models compete and fight for superiority and greater fundamental truth is what good thinking is all about. It's hard work, but that's the only way to get the right answers." These mental models are wonderful not just because they help you understand the world, but because they additionally let you understand yourself and improve your own decision-making. Here are a few select mental models from Farnham Street from the human nature category. These are the ones I see myself in, sometimes painfully so. Number one, tendency to want to do something. We might term this boredom syndrome. Most humans have the tendency to need to act, even when their actions are not needed. We also tend to offer solutions, even when we do not have enough knowledge to solve the problem. This model describes exactly why I started roughly half of the failed projects I've started in my life, because I wanted to do something. Second up, first conclusion bias. As Charlie Munger famously pointed out, the mind works a bit like a sperm and egg. The first idea gets in, and then the mind shuts. Like many other tendencies, this is probably an energy-saving device. Our tendency to settle on first conclusions leads us to accept many erroneous results and cease asking questions. It can be countered with some simple and useful mental routines. The first conclusion bias is a great explanation for how I selected many of the failed projects I started. And finally, the mental model that probably makes me cringe the most when I think about it. Number three, the commitment and consistency bias. As psychologists have frequently and famously demonstrated, humans are subject to a bias towards keeping their prior commitments and staying consistent with our prior selves when possible. This trait is necessary for social cohesion. People who often change their conclusions and habits are often distrusted. Yet our bias towards staying consistent can become, as one wag put it, a hobgoblin of foolish minds. When it is combined with the first conclusion bias, we end up landing on poor answers and standing pat in the face of great evidence. The commitment and consistency bias, finally, describes why I keep developing failed projects long after understanding that they'd likely fail. I'd encourage everyone to visit Farnham Street and check out these mental models. For the casual reader, they are a wonderful sampling of human knowledge and understanding. But for a more dedicated reader, they may be a step forward in improving how you evaluate decisions and the world around you. If you haven't been inundated with stories about privacy leaks over the last few months, congratulations! You are doing an admirable job preserving your sanity. Here are a few of the top trending headlines in the tech community over the last few weeks. 1.1.1 Fast Privacy First Consumer DNS Service. U.S. cell carriers are selling access to real-time phone location data. Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon pose a greater surveillance risk than Facebook. The list of headlines goes on and on. The thread of the story is not new to the tech community. What's new is the rest of the world is finally catching on. The response to these stories is, very understandably, a mix of outrage and shock. So, of interest to me was a trending blog written about exploiting the massive amount of personal data Facebook has. The title? How I Targeted the Reddit CEO with Facebook Ads to Get an Interview at Reddit. The story is one I've seen written a few times over the years. An engineer micro-targets a high-profile exec, in this case the CEO of Reddit, with ads to get on his radar for a job interview. From the blog, it turns out the Reddit CEO had a public Facebook profile, so I could go there to see details about him, where he lived, what he was interested in. I took that info to the Facebook platform to help narrow down the campaign, but I didn't want everyone to click on it, just one person. So I custom tailored the ad to directly target the one person I wanted to read it. Steve, Reddit needs recommendations. The result was success. Steve Huffman, CEO of Reddit, did indeed see the ad, clicked on it, and reached out to arrange an interview. The response from the tech community? Overwhelming admiration. But wait, let's back up. This technique was fundamentally enabled by the same type of ad technology bemoaned by the press and the tech community of late. To be clear, there are very, very hard differences between this and something like Cambridge Analytica, in which vast troves of user data was captured without the clear consent of users on Facebook, friends of friends using an app collecting data on them. But there are also similarities. How many of Facebook's users realize that this kind of micro-targeting is possible? Someone with a public Facebook profile, as Huffman has, is most likely aware that their profile details are publicly available. But many users make these details publicly available, their location and interests. The crux of this micro-targeting technique is making the guess that the more you know about a person, the fewer people there are who fit the profile at the cross-section of all of this data. The assumption which most users make on the other end is that they can stay relatively anonymous while sharing seemingly innocuous pieces of information, like location and their interests. This is the inherent tension at the heart of sharing personal data with companies like Facebook or Google, who then repackage this data to advertisers. There is a false sense of anonymity when I open up Google and type best baby strollers, and am then surprised that Google and the advertisers it serves have caught on that I am someone who has two young children. The more pieces of information that are known about me, the smaller the cross-section of the world is that fits those pieces of information. There are millions of people in New York City. There are far fewer with my first name and employment history. So who cares? Why does it matter that this data or targeting exists? I don't have any answers to this. It's a story that is still being written about how we as a society approach privacy issues. My own feeling is that many of us have an allergic reaction to the notion that advertisers are influencing us without our knowledge. But that is exactly what advertisers are paying money to do. And the type of influence which is possible is becoming more and more sophisticated as more of our data is captured by advertisers and platforms are able to micro-target us using that data. So why is this influence, on the one hand, lauded by the tech community as an example of a clever hack to get the attention of the CEO of Reddit, but derided when companies like Cambridge Analytica use similar techniques to build profiles on and target users? I suspect the answer rests on notions of consent, awareness, and desire. Huffman, with a public profile and as a CEO of a tech company, was presumably vaguely aware that he could be targeted in this way, and ultimately pleased by finding a potential recruit who cleverly used the system to reach out to him. And much of the tech community has been aware of these techniques for some time now. But it isn't hard to imagine the same techniques being used in more undesirable ways. And as the rest of the world catches up on these techniques, we'll likely find that there is more outrage and new norms are established. That's all for Hacker Daily today, Friday, May 25th. You can reach us with feedback or comments via email at info@hackerdaily.co or follow us on Twitter @HackerDaily. And we'll be back next week with more updates for hackers, founders, and makers. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.